tonight's episode of National Review Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, rbnrepublicbroadcasting.org. It's the rainy day of free speech, but we know you've been saving up for a rainy day. So send that money you've been saving up to republicbroadcasting.org. Click on the donate button. Send the fundage to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Phone it into 1-800-724-2719. Today is Monday. We have Mark Collett with us. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello. It is indeed the rainy day of free speech, and I am the wet Mark Collett of free speech, who had to walk home in the rain as it got progressively worse. So, yes, not in the best mood I've ever been in. I'll start by saying that. Not in the best mood I've ever been in. But we do have lots of things to discuss. And I've got to say, the situation that's developing in Lebanon is frightening. It really is frightening. And I think we are seeing the world sort of lurch a step closer, if you like, to genuinely to World War III. I think we are seeing the world on the brink, and largely this is down to the meddling of Zionists. And in the case of Lebanon, this is Zionist aggression at its very worst.
It's so bald-faced, so blatant, and yet because of pro-Zionist Jewish domination of the mainstream media, you've got certainly the older generations in the United States and probably most of Europe, you could tell me about that, that just seems to think Israel can do no wrong, that it's a perpetual victim. Younger people, it's probably a different score. And the Netanyahu government is just lurching forward. They are pulling out all the stops and have no restraints. Nobody's putting any restraints on them so far. You keep having the president of Iran saying that, you know, we're going to cut off your hands or whatever. We'll see. On the other hand, the other main development are in Ukraine, and the Russian military is just, or the Ukrainian military is more and more depleted. And that we're just, it's like waiting for the other shoe to drop when that.
Can I jump in here, Patrick? I don't know if you saw the other day, it was a very, very interesting admission on CNN that Russia are producing three times the amount of shells as are getting delivered to the Ukraine. And that's very, very interesting, because for a long time we've heard that, oh, Russia's on the edge, you know, Russia can't fight back, they're 2 days away from, you know, losing the war, etc., etc., etc. But what seems to actually be happening here is quite different to what we're being told. And interestingly, what's going on in the Ukraine seems to be now falling apart even quicker, and if anything, the Russians almost seem to be galvanizing support within Russia, getting on a better and better war footing, and they don't seem to be losing the same number of people that we're seeing lost in from the Ukrainian military. And now, obviously, you know, that's not really a reason to particularly, you know, be happy, because you're still losing lots of white people, but it does go to show that the media's sort of enthusiastic sort of embrace of this war and frequent and repetitive broadcasts about how close it is to being won, every now and again it just cracks, doesn't it? And they let out this little sort of squeak of truth. And when you hear that little bit of truth, you think, oh my gosh, this is absolutely horrendous, because obviously all these people in Ukraine are going to be young men now, and now older men are going to be perishing because of this. You know, the West has gambled not only with its own wealth and its own military stockpiles, but with the blood of Ukrainian men.
Right. And you've got also Russia diplomatically, their standing across the world has really never been stronger. And there's going to be a BRICS summit in about, what, 3 or 4 weeks in Kazan, Russia. Kazan is a city in Russia. It's the capital of the Tatar Autonomous Republic. And you've got loads of countries who are applying to be members of BRICS. That's one thing. You know, countries that have been traditionally close to the United States, like Thailand, for instance. But also, there's at the BRICS conference, they're going to be developing the architecture of a new economic system for the world. Some people are saying this could turn out to be another Bretton Woods. 80 years ago in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, there was a meeting of the countries that were on the verge of winning World War II, and they drew up plans for the IMF and the World Bank and what eventually became the World Trade Organization, and established the dollar as the international reserve currency, and just set up the infrastructure of the post-war economic order. And so, and that seems to be what is going to transpire in Kazan, Russia later this or next month. How far they're going to get with that, who knows, but that's the direction they're moving in. And the thing is with, circling back to Lebanon, Israel acts with impunity, and it has acted with impunity and utter ruthlessness because it's been able to get away with it. And it's been able to get away with it because it's had the backing of the United States, and sometimes only the United States. All these UN resolutions in the Security Council, often they're 14 in favor, one opposed, but because the one opposed is United States and United States has a veto, then they fail. How much longer is the United States going to have the power and prestige to effectively have Israel's back like this? So anyway, I can't get back to you.
Do you want me to answer that question?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, let me explain to you, if I can be so bold as to, and this might sound quite arrogant to say this, but let me explain how something such as sanctions actually works. And you might be thinking, well, we all know how sanctions work, Mark. You know, it's pretty obvious. You know, sanctions work because there's a group of countries, and one country is then basically told it can't play with the rest, so has to sit out on its own in the cold. And that is how sanctions work. And that might seem like a very obvious thing to say. So why am I saying something very obvious? Well, the problem is, if you have a group of, let's say, 50 countries, and they come together and they kick one out and say, right, we're sanctioning you, you're being kicked out, we don't want you in our club, you're finished, you're done, you're out of the club. Well, that's actually a pretty tough thing for that one country to deal with, because you have effectively been sanctioned. You have to do something about it. What can you do? I mean, at the end of the day, you're out of the club. You've got 49 countries in the club and you're out of the club. That's a bad place to be. But if the club then throws out another country, all of a sudden, the two countries that are being thrown out aren't in as bad a place as the one country was when it was thrown out on its own. Now, what happens next? Well, I'll tell you what happens next. The club, with now 48 countries in, you know, over a period of time, throws out another 16, 17, 18 countries. And all of a sudden, that 50 countries is now a club of 30 countries. And those outside the club are actually a decent number of countries. And all of a sudden, if you sanction one more country, it doesn't actually have any effect, does it? It stops having its effect. Why does it stop having its effect? Because if you keep playing the sanctions game, eventually you end up with too many people on the other side of the boundary. You know, you actually end up with a club of sanctioned countries. And that's what basically happened with America. America have sanctioned countries in Southern America. They've sanctioned countries in the East, in Eastern Europe. They've sanctioned countries in the Middle East. And what have all these countries done? They said, well, we've all been thrown out of the big US club. Well, okay, there's enough of us to make our own clubhouse and do something ourselves. And that actually puts them in a powerful position. But not only does it put them in a powerful position, fundamentally, it actually puts America in a less powerful position. Because all of a sudden, the Americans are not in the position that they once were. Americans are not in that position where they can say, you've been thrown out of our club. Ha ha, how much does that hurt you and your economy? Well, it doesn't as much as it used to. And it's not going to. Why? Because all of the people that have been thrown out have networked. So America says, right, we're not going to buy your oil. And Russia says, okay, well, you've also got sort of sanctions on this country and this country and this country. How about, you know, we sell our oil there? And these countries are like, oh, fantastic. You know, we were sanctioned, so we were finding it difficult to get certain things, but now Russia's come to our aid. And all of a sudden, those outside the American-dominated clubhouse have got their own clubhouse. And at that point, America's got another problem, because not only are these countries powerful in their own right now, and not only is their own bloc powerful, but America are less powerful as a country, and the American clubhouse is less desirable. But then something else happens as well that's even worse, because America's stick with the sanctions is if you don't do what America wants, they sanction you. But if you play ball, the sanctions are removed and you can sell your oil, you can sell your goods, and, you know, America takes its, you know, foot off your economic neck. But if there's a club that exists outside of the club that's dominated by America, what incentive is there for anybody to do what America wants anymore? Like, if America says to a country, well, you know, if you start playing ball, we're going to do this for you. They're going to say, well, we don't need to do that. We don't need to bend over backwards. We don't need to come to an agreement with you, because we've already got customers. There's already a completely different economic system that we can go to. We can sell our goods. We can sell our services. We can work with people. We don't have to do what you are telling us to do. And at that point, America becomes a rather impotent country, and it doesn't have the power that it once did. And I think that's where we're getting to with America. America just does not have the clout it once did. And now you've got countries like Iran, you've got countries like Russia, China, and they're doing well, and they're doing well without America. And the deals that they've struck amongst themselves are probably more favorable than anything they would have got from America anyway. So it's probably a blessing in disguise. And this constantly depletes America. And you can see the effects of some of this depletion in the fact that when America basically wanted to bomb, destroy, and more or less level Syria, who stepped in? Russia stepped in. And what could America do about it? Very little. And I think what we're seeing now is pretty much a reorientation of the world order. And that reorientation of the world order is something that I believe will fundamentally worry the Judeo-American state. And moving into what looks like a ground war in Lebanon, what are the implications of that? Well, Russia are increasingly speaking out about the actions taken by Israel. Iran is a partner with Russia, so it's not as if America can just attack one of Russia's partners just outright. And all of a sudden, this has actually weakened in many ways Israel's domination of the world. Now, I'm not saying that Israel's on the brink of collapse, or that in the next couple of days or weeks or maybe even years we'll see that. But we are seeing a shift in the global center of power. And that is something which is going to have a dramatic effect on Israel. And Israel, with their close ties to America, especially to the American State Department, is not going to be a country that I believe will work well with Russia. I think there's a, you know, for the foreseeable future, I think there's a lasting split there between the two.
Mm-hmm. So I agree with what you're saying. The United States, their position has been fundamentally weakened. The sanctions have backfired. I mean, people talk about the sanctions backfiring in Ukraine, but the sanctions have backfired in general. And there's a certain amount of recognition of it. And for what it's worth, Donald Trump has been criticizing Janet Yellen for sanctions. And so there's even some discussion of that in the mainstream in the United States. Now, as for Israel, they are going to be able to kill lots of Lebanese. They're very good at just raining down death on people. They've been raining down death for almost a full year now on the people of Gaza. And, you know, that while people say, I guess the deathometer has been stuck at about 40,000 for months, as if nobody's dying still. And I'm continually hearing statistics based on that. The other day on what Abby Martin or somebody on one of these podcasts said, two infants every day are dying in Gaza. And it's like, well, two infants are dying every day in Gaza if you're extrapolating from 40,000 deaths over a period of a year. But it's way more. Well, actually, it would even be more than 40,000 two babies per day. But it's way more. I mean, obviously, it's some multiple of 40,000 that have died. It's how can you know? They're very good at this, and they're going to be killing lots and lots of people in Lebanon. I mean, already the totals we're hearing about are, you know, 800-900. They're good at killing lots of people. These are typically random people. They have killed the leader of Hezbollah. That means somebody else will be taking over Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, you know, they've been around for around 40 years now. There will be somebody, you kill a leader, somebody else takes over. Often that person is even more radicalized, if that's the term you want to use, because of the assassination of their close comrade. So, you know, they killed Nasrallah, they've killed Ismail Haniyeh in Hamas. And what progress have they made towards their stated goals? While they've reduced Gaza to rubble, they haven't moved the Palestinians out. The Palestinians are staying there. And if they've stayed there through all of this, what's the odds that they're going to leave now? The king of Jordan has rejected any idea of accepting refugees from Palestine, because that would just be, well, it would be completely unacceptable to his own people, because they know what that would mean. It would mean ceding the land to Israel and giving it what it wants. And more than half the people in Jordan are there because they got pushed out of Israel 80 years ago. So Israel's they're not close to meeting their stated goals. They're becoming increasingly a pariah, because while they may be a darling on Sky News or Fox News or whatever, they may be a darling for the populations of the countries that are going to be represented at Kazan later next month. They're a pariah, and you know, there's a limit to how long this can go on. It's not a stable situation. like you, I'm not necessarily predicting that Israel won't exist in a year or two, but their continued existence is much more an open question now than it was a year ago, and that it needs to be. It's Israel. The last thing I'll say, their big problem is they don't know how to say yes to a very generous offer. They had generous offers from everyone from, you know, the president of Egypt to the leader of Hamas, everybody in between. They could have had a state in the pre-1967 boundaries. Everybody would have lived with them, but they won't. They keep grabbing for more and more and more. They've never established their own boundaries, and they're just always going for more and more and more, double or nothing. And like I say, sooner or later, if you do double or nothing, you're going to wind up with nothing. So back to you, Mark.
I've never heard that phrase before. Sooner or later, if you go double or nothing, you're going to end up with nothing. I've never heard that before, but that is quite good.
I'd say that. It's yeah. True.
I think a lot of this is purely Netanyahu's greed and madness. I think he believes that this is sort of his manifest destiny, if you like, that this is his war. This is going to be his legacy, and he's going to do something that is going to really, really secure a greater Israel for his people. And that's his goal. And he knows that he has an incredible amount of support from the American system. He knows that the American system is always going to do what he wants them to do, and that puts him in a very, very powerful position. And I think what we're seeing here in terms of America's relationship with Israel, and I've said this on other shows, is at the moment America are acting like the school bully, and Israel are the school bully's irritating little sibling. So what you have is Israel not actually being as powerful as they think, and they're sat at the back of the class firing spitballs at all the other children, and any child that stands up and says, look, that spitball hit me in the back of the neck, and if you do one more, I'm going to break your nose, the school bully stands up and says, you're not, that's my little brother, you're not touching him. And I think that's where America are coming in here, because what you've essentially got is Israel launching missiles at Iran, Lebanon, parts of Syria, Gaza, but anything that comes back their way, and America and the UK actually step in and will do everything in their power to make sure not a single oversized firework lands on Israeli soil. And that, I think, is an accurate assessment of the relationship between America and Israel, because I don't think America is going to be fighting this conflict. I don't think you're going to actually see, you know, American boots on the ground or America, you know, laying waste to parts of Lebanon. I think America are there in the Middle East to prevent other Middle Eastern countries from standing up for what's right, for standing up against Israel.
Yeah. You know, I recorded a couple of shows with Dr. Duke yesterday. They'll be played today and tomorrow. And in the show, I believe the show for tomorrow, he had a recording of Donald Trump, who was being interviewed by somebody. And he was, I guess it was intended for a Jewish audience. And he was talking about his relationship with Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. Of course, Sheldon Adelson famously gave Donald Trump $100 million in his first campaign. And now Miriam, his widow, has apparently given him or pledged $100 million for this campaign. And he was saying, yeah, when he was living in the White House during those 4 years, nobody, nobody came over to the White House more than Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. They were there. He saw them more than he saw the people who worked at the White House. He saw them more often. And every time they came, they're always asking for something. He was saying this. They're always asking for something. And, you know, I gave them the embassy and I gave them the Golan Heights. They didn't even ask for the Golan Heights. I just gave it to them. They didn't even ask for it. But they're always asking for something. It's like, what a strange thing to be saying. And like I said, I'm not exactly sure where he was speaking, where the venue was. It seemed to be for a Jewish audience. So I guess he was just trying to say how great he was for the Jews, that he was giving them even more than they were asking for. But it was really strange to be saying this out in public. And I don't know. What do you make of that, saying, you know, I do anything for them. They gave me a lot of money and they spent all this time at the White House and I gave them everything they wanted and more. And they kept asking for more even after when I was giving them things they hadn't asked for. What do you make of that?
I don't know. I think that Trump sometimes says things and he's in his own head. I think it sounds better than it comes out to other people. I think undoubtedly he's trying to say to everyone, hey, look, you know, when you guys ask, I give, you know, when you guys say, right, we want something, the Trumpster says, yeah, you can have it. I think that's really what he's getting at, isn't he? I think that he's trying to say to people that, you know, when the Jews say, you know, we want, he's just like, well, how much do you want? You know, and he's basically saying that he's going to put it on the plate for them. But I do think it's odd that he says these things, because I've heard David Duke in the past, and I don't agree with David on this, but he says this. He says that he thinks that, like, when Trump says this, it's almost like somebody who's been taken hostage, and he's, you know, they're trying to sort of signal to other people that they've been taken hostage. You know, like, you know, if somebody sat there and they're like, are you okay? And they're like, yeah, I'm okay. Wink, 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 you know, and it's because they're not actually okay. They've been taken hostage. And I think sometimes that's how Trump comes over. And when he does these things, I'm actually sort of shocked to some degree, because Trump is the kind of guy who, he's not thick. You know, he's an intelligent man. And I think anyone that said Trump was stupid would be really, really underestimating the guy. But he certainly isn't stupid. But some of the things he says, you start to think, well, if he's not stupid, why is he saying that? Because surely that would make the Adelsons a little bit uncomfortable. And if he was trying to say to the Jews, look, I'll give you everything, you know, in some underhanded way, it's kind of lets everyone else in on what's going on, doesn't it? It's not the most subtle way to do things. So I sometimes wonder what's going on in Trump's head. But I suppose a lot of people wonder what's going on in Trump's head. And it's one of those things that's kind of unfathomable.
Well, so on the one hand, you've had Joe Biden, and his history has been foot and mouth disease, you know, saying that, going in front of a group of, I guess it was like the Democratic Party's Jewish Association, I don't know what it's called, going in front of them and saying, hey, we wouldn't have gay marriage if it wasn't for you. I mean, 80-90% of the people who are pushing gay marriage were Jews, and so we have you to thank for it. Thank you. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. Hey, we wouldn't have gay marriage if it wasn't for you. I mean, 80-90% of the people who are pushing gay marriage were Jews, and so we have you to thank for it. Thank you. And or going in front of the Kennedy School of Government and saying, well, we have a problem with our allies who keep giving ISIS money and weapons. You know, we have a problem with our allies doing that. And then he also, you know, was giving an interview somewhere. I can't remember exactly where it was. And he was talking about having gone to Ukraine and demanding that President Zelensky, I guess it would have been Poroshenko at the time, demanding that President Poroshenko fire the prosecutor who was looking into the company that his son was a director at. And they said, well, we can't fire the prosecutor. And he said, well, you don't fire the prosecutor. I'm not giving you this, you know, such and such $1 billion of aid. And they said, well, you can't do that. Only Obama can do that. And he says, yeah, you want to see? I'm going to get on that plane in 3 hours. If you haven't fired the prosecutor, you're not going to get the money. Well, son of a gun, they fired the prosecutor. He says these things in public. And Trump the same way. You know, he has said things like, nobody, you know, you look at these demonstrations against Israel, nobody would have dared demonstrate against Israel. Nobody would say these things before because the Israeli lobby was so strong. And now look at what's happened. People are doing this. Even Chuck Schumer sounds like a Palestinian now. Nobody would have dared protest against Israel before because the Israel lobby is so strong. What's happened here? What, you know, what's going on here? As if it's a bad thing. And he does these things in public. And, you know, in the case of Biden, Biden just has always had a tendency to stick his foot in his mouth. He has always had a tendency to say things he wasn't supposed to say. With Trump, I mean, these sound like things that, I mean, it's bizarre, I guess. Most likely, it's just kind of he's got this, you know, he brags a lot about things, and maybe it plays into just wanting to brag about things and be hyperbolic about things. But he sure is letting the cat out of the bag. I mean, it is true that the Israeli lobby has been super strong. And, you know, it is true that he was given away. I mean, certain things he wasn't given away. Netanyahu certainly wanted him to go to war with Iran, and he didn't do that. Not that any other president, Obama, didn't do it either. But yeah, it's just putting mouth disease, letting the cat out of the bag. And yet, how much does the listening public catch on? What do you think, Mark? Does a listening public hear these things and say, "Wait a minute"? That's actually not a good thing. It's not a good thing that you did all of those things for Jews. Why would you do all those things for Jews? It's how much catching on is there in the listening public?
I think there is catching on. Okay, I'm not saying there's a huge amount, but there is. Now, there's two types. There are people like ourselves who will hear this kind of stuff, and we will make compilations, we'll clip it out, we'll discuss it. There'll be memes going round where all of Donald Trump's most ridiculously over-the-top philo-Semitic statements will be sort of cobbled together. And, you know, all of that is important. But I kind of think he says some of these things to appeal to a certain type of boomer and to appeal to people he thinks going to help him attain power. You know, I think he is, to some degree, being quite genuine in his sycophantic nature. And, you know, that might sound odd to be, you know, genuine in his sycophantic nature, but I think he is being. I think he's doing this because he believes it makes him an appealing option to a certain demographic, a demographic of people who are, you know, one, wealthy Jews that have power and influence will help him with his campaign. But number two, I think he's trying to appeal to a certain type of, you know, boomer audience that lives in that era when, you know, people believed Israel to be, you know, an unquestionable power, that if you said anything against them, it was taboo, you know, and it was, you know, there are a group of people, you know, in this country who absolutely believe that any criticism of Israel is almost the greatest taboo and that Israel should be supported in every way. Now, those people are actually, you know, they're dying out and they're getting fewer in number, it seems. But you see this with, say, I would say the Daily Mail comment section. The Daily Mail comment section is absolutely horrific. It's basically people who just think that the Jews can do no wrong, that what they do in, you know, in Lebanon, Gaza is completely justified in every single way, and that anybody that speaks out against such a thing is a monster. That those sort of people, they exist very much in the realm of, as I say, the Daily Mail comment section. And the Daily Mail comment section now is awash with this kind of commentary, and it's all voted up. You've sort of the best voted comments are things, you know, when the pager bombs went off in Lebanon, the best voted comments were people who were, you know, in awe of what had happened, were praising it. They were like, this is what we need, this is how a country deals with a terror threat. And you're reading it and it's very, very ghoulish, but those people do think like that. But interestingly, they're also, a lot of them, the kind of people who actually are some of the most race blind in society. So although these people think Jews have an absolute right to do what they want and defend their homeland, they're also people that if you say, well, what about a homeland for white people, they'd jump back in horror and start talking about how, you know, America's a country. They're anti-immigration, but they fundamentally don't believe in an all-white America or a majority white America on the basis of race. You know, it'd be a majority white America in their eyes on the basis of merit, because they think everything should be done on merit. But if all of a sudden, you know, 20 million blacks from Africa arrived on America's shores and got better, you know, got a higher score on an IQ test than the whites, they're the sort of people who would let them in. So I do find it kind of funny that you have that, and you sort of have that with Nigel Farage as well. So Nigel Farage will say, look, I'm against immigration, we've got to stop immigration, we can't have these people coming in. Fact of the matter is, if they do come in, it's going to make life worse for everyone. And then somebody will say to him, but is that because the English will become a minority? He'll be like, oh God, no, that's not my issue. I don't mind what colour you are if you come here, as long as you are, you know, as long as you basically love the country and wave a little plastic Union Jack when it's the, you know, some royal holiday, you know, you're welcome to come here. But then when Farage ever gets interviewed about Israel, you can imagine what he says. Oh, the Jews need a place to live. The Jews must have a homeland, to talk about the Jewish homeland in a way that fundamentally suggests that they're not entitled to it, or they might lose it. It'd be the greatest crime known to humanity for the Jews to lose their homeland. But on the other hand, as I've just said, he is the guy that doesn't believe the English deserve a homeland. And I think those people, it's hard to realign their thinking, let's put it like that. With people like Nigel Farage, and people say, oh no, Nigel Farage is just a Jewish shill, he's just this, he's just that. And you know, to some degree, you could just write him off in that way. But from my perspective, I would look at somebody like Nigel and say, is he actually a Jewish shill? Or is he somebody that was just brought up with that sort of understanding? And he's another one that sometimes puts his foot in his mouth, because Farage is one that will occasionally say things like, well, yeah, Jews do control banking. They do a great job. They're so intelligent. They control all the financial services. You know, that's why they've got everyone in the media. They bloody run the media, don't they? But that's just because they're so intelligent. And then they'll be like, say, you know, then he'll have to apologize, because, you know, what people don't realize is, or what he doesn't realize is, that saying that, you know, confirms what they don't want to be confirmed, which is that they do run the banking and the media, etc. But he will say those things, and he doesn't seem to think there's anything wrong with saying those things, because he believes that's praise. It's high praise to him if you run a bank or you control a media empire. And I think it's difficult with that generation of people, because they do have a fundamentally different outlook on the world. And I was discussing this last night, saying that in all these European countries where, you know, soft right-wing parties like the AfD or the National Rally are polling well, they poll best amongst a younger demographic. You'd think that they'd be polling best amongst the oldest demographic. The, you know, intuition tells you that if you're going to talk about taking things back to a better time, the people who are going to want to go back to that better time are probably going to be slightly older. They're going to remember that better time. But no, that's not the way it works. It's actually the younger people that want change. And I think it's because that boomer generation, sort of Trump's generation, Farage's generation, the people who were, you know, the people that Trump's trying to reach out to when he says these things about Israel, they have been so indoctrinated. They've been so, you know, from literally the cradle to the grave, they have, you know, immerse themselves in mainstream media, that I do think it is, I'm not making excuses for them, I do think it is more difficult for them to get a grasp of the topics that we discuss.
So, you know, maybe we talk about boomers. I'm a boomer. You mentioned the Daily Mail comment section. They thought the pager explosions were so great. I remember, and this is probably 50 years ago, but the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, sent a bunch of letter bombs to British government offices, and they blew up. That, I mean, the pagers, it's the exact same thing. It's just the technology is a little more advanced, and it's on a much broader scale. How many pagers blew up? Was it thousands? Thousands? It wasn't thousands of letter bombs that the IRA sent to British offices, and yet would these same people who write letters praising Israel's pager bombs, would they have been in favor of the IRA? Maybe would they like the IRA to start sending letter bombs again? Do you think, would that be a good thing? Or was it okay that they did? Are they going to apologize for having opposed the letter bombs in the first place?
Well, this is the issue. This is the issue in this country. It's one that's quite interesting. You see, in Britain, there's this thing that we have called British values. And one of the fundamental things that was part of British values, and when I say British values, I'm talking about the things that were genuinely said in the past in relation to how British people think. And I remember as a child, one of the big things that was always said was two wrongs don't make a right. And that was always sort of hammered into our minds as children. So if you were out in the playground and somebody stole your ball and pushed you into a muddy puddle, you know, if you went and pushed them back and knocked them into a muddy puddle and, you know, stole something off them for what they'd done to you, that was not the right thing to do. That was wrong. It was fundamentally a bad thing, because two wrongs never made a right, apparently. And when dealing with the IRA, the idea wasn't to show them that Britain could be a greater terrorist threat to their people than they could be to our people. The idea was that some form of justice was enacted, that the people who did this were brought to justice, that they were treated like criminals, that they fundamentally got a fair trial, and that then, you know, they, if found guilty, they went to jail for this. Now, that is something that was just drummed into us again and again. And if you speak to these sort of boomer types, they would understand what I'm saying. However, strangely, with Israel, that's not something that always shines through, which sounds really odd, doesn't it? Saying like, well, you know, this is a British value, all these boomers would understand it. But fundamentally, when it comes to Israel, it's like Israel gets this free pass. So when Israel does it, it's like, well, it doesn't really matter because it's Israel. When Israel does it, it doesn't matter because they can do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, etc., etc., etc. And that, for your boomer population, is a strange thing, because they were brought up with this idea of like the good guys behaving differently to the bad guys. So, you know, the idea was that if you were a good guy, which they believe, obviously, Israel, they believe Israel to be the good guys. God, is there any hope for them? But they do believe Israel to be the good guys, these boomers. But along with that, they for some reason think Israel should have the right, you know, to be the bad guy. And that's really strange. I've always found this a great contradiction, because it does go against our value system. But I think a lot of this is because Jews have been put on such a pedestal for so long, and a lot of these people have been deeply affected by things such as the Holocaust narrative, that, you know, they actually believe that, you know, Jews are a special case, and that because of, you know, the Holocaust, they should be allowed to do things or should be given a given leeway that no other group is allowed to be given. So if another group went out and took vengeance, they would be like, oh, that goes too far. But and this isn't even vengeance. This is the other thing which I find really difficult with these boomers, is this isn't even vengeance. So there were some people who were squeamish about what Russian special forces did to those terrorists who were recently caught after a massacre on Russian soil. And obviously, famously, one of those terrorists, he had his ear cut off and it was forced in his own mouth. And they, you know, they did, the Russians did treat them with, how can I say it? The Russians did treat them in a brutal way. They brutalized them when extracting information from them. And I think some people might say, well, that is justice because those people had committed horrific acts. However, in Lebanon, what part of this is justice? You know, when you've got these pager bombs going off and they're tearing, you know, children to pieces. And there was actually a case where a little girl heard the pager going, ran to get it because she always fetches it for daddy, and it blew her to pieces. You know, that actually did happen. You know, how is that justice? How is something as indiscriminate as that justice? How is the widespread shelling of a civilian area justice? At that point, that if they'd done something wrong to you, that might be seen as vengeance. It certainly wouldn't be seen as justice. But I'm not sure what Lebanon has done to Israel. I'm not sure why Israel are doing this. I mean, they're telling us it's to deplete Hezbollah, because Hezbollah are terrorists, apparently. But the interesting thing about this is it's not like Hezbollah have just launched a major offensive and this is a retaliation. This seems to me, you know, if I was going to categorize it, it seems to me to be a case of Israel saying, look, we've got where we need to be almost in Gaza. We've depleted them. We've forced them out. why don't we do Lebanon as well? And I think this is just part of the greater Israel project. I don't think this is anything deeper than a land grab. I don't think there's anything more to this than a land grab. I think it's naked genocide, and it's going to result in what, if any other group was doing it, it'd be called colonization, wouldn't it?
Well, they certainly are interested, or some people in the Israeli government are, they covet southern Lebanon. They see that southern Lebanon, maybe even more than just that, as part of eventual greater Israel. And I mentioned before, the Israelis have never established their boundaries. And I've been in a Jewish day school. I looked at a map of Israel that they had on the wall, and it had all the cities on it, but it didn't have boundaries. I mean, there are certain demarcations, but there was certainly no boundary. There was no boundary to the east. So does it stop at the Green Line? Does it stop at the Jordan River? Does it go across Jordan? There was no boundary. And this is one of the things that when Arab leaders or Arab proponents are asked, doesn't Israel have a right to exist, which is a stupid question, because actually countries don't have a right to exist under international law. But putting that aside, sometimes the comeback is, exist where? They don't say where their boundaries are. Where do they exist? We're supposed to accept their right to exist, and they don't even say where. So you have issues like that as well. Anyway, we're starting to run up towards the end of our time. Do you have any other projects you're working on? Anything interesting going on?
Well, in the UK, my organization, Patriotic Alternative, we have done a bit of a pivot in what we've been doing. We've done plenty of activism in the past, but we've now reached a point where there is an awful lot of people who are languishing in British jails for speech crimes, thought crimes, and for being involved in some of the disorder that took place in the wake of the murders of the little girls in Southport. And we as an organisation have so far raised £14,000 for the families of people who have been jailed unfairly. We have started distributing that money, and that's a major project that we're working on at the moment. So as we speak, we have a working group that is buzzing away, identifying women with children who've been jailed, dads who've been jailed, which has caused them to lose their jobs, so their kids aren't going to have much money come Christmas. And we are doing our very, very best to ensure that those people are looked after and get some financial assistance. So if you go to our website, patrioticalternative.org.uk, you can see that, and you can see other good work that we do.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me, Mark.
Well, thank you so much, and I'll see you same time next week.
And I'll be back again next time with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Jews didn't do it. Jews didn't do it. Jews didn't do it. Jews didn't do it. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. I want to shill like a faggot for the Jews. Shill like a faggot. I get hot takes from Fox News. I want to shill like a faggot named Ted Cruz. Oh Lord, it's like prostitution. Bomb Dawson's. Don't let them drink or eat. Bomb the children, blow those shoes off their feet. Bomb their houses, see them living in the street. Now that's a final solution. I want to chill like a faggot for the Jews. chill like a faggot. From Fox News I get my cues. I want to chill like a faggot. Name it Cruz. How I love prostitution. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. Cash keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into my pocket. Jews didn't do it. 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 I want to shill like a faggot for the Jews. Shill like a faggot. I get hot takes from Fox News. I want to shill like a faggot. Name Ted Cruz. How I love prostitution. Jews didn't do it. Jews didn't do it. Jews didn't do it.
Collected by voluntary compliance. Get the information you need to help you avoid income tax with these five easy steps. All you have to do is go to avoidincometax.com to get your five easy steps on how to avoid the IRS income tax. Escape the IRS. Let avoidincometax.com help you. We guarantee our five easy steps or your money back. Go to avoidincometax.com.
Hey, do you have a house or office with a musty smell or mold? Studies have shown that essential oils like the ones in our Thief and Robbers blend will kill or inhibit mold, viruses, bacteria, or fungus. Just diffuse with it, and you'll see the long-lasting effects that even synthetic chemicals don't achieve. Check us out at SusannahSecret.com. That's S-U-S-A-N-A-S, Secret.com. That's S-U-S-A-N-A-S, Secret.com.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.